Welcome everybody to this plenary lunch. Can you hear me even in the back? Can you hear me down there? Yeah, okay. Welcome to the plenary lunch of the Society for French Historical Studies 64th annual meeting. My co-president Jotham and I hope that you are having a great conference and that you are enjoying Pittsburgh, which when I came here, I was told this is actually the Paris of the Appalachia. So welcome to Paris. When we started organizing this conference, we both agreed that given the centrality of Pittsburgh to the history of France in North America, we would want to have a keynote on this theme. And as soon as we decided this topic, we more or less both burst out, "Well, Catherine Desbarras!" So we were truly delighted when Kate, upon our invitation, accepted it and has decided to join us here today. Kate is an associate professor of history at McGill University in Montreal and is widely renowned for her scholarship on the history of the French Empire in North America. And she has a somewhat unusual scholarly trajectory. As an undergrad, she majored in both history and economics at Queen's University. And from here, she moved on to complete first a DPhil in economics at Oxford University in 1987, and then a PhD in history from McGill University in 1994. It's with her expertise in both of these arenas that she's able to enrich numerous fields and subfields in history, including the history of the French colonial empire, state finance, governance, indigenous North America, and the history of New France. Kate has written, co-written, and edited numerous volumes, books, journals, articles, chapters, and reviews, and it's going to be impossible for me to list them all here. So I have selected some that I think really demonstrate her impressive range. Kate's first book is entitled Empirical Modeling of Canadian Petroleum Exploration Activity, which was published by Oxford Institute for Energy Studies in 1989. Her next publication came out in 1992, 3 years later, and many may have been surprised, particularly those in the field of energy studies, because Kate now wrote about, and here I quote the first title, Aquaculture Within the Seigneurial Regime of 18th Century Canada. Since then, her articles on New France, empire, finance, and historiography have appeared in top history journals, including the William & Mary Quarterly, the Journal of Early American History, the Revue d'Histoire de l'Amérique Française, and the Canadian Historical Review. She's co-edited a number of books and special issues, such as the special issue on New France and the Atlantic World for the Revue d'Histoire de l'Amérique in 2011, and a forthcoming co-edited anthology entitled Alexis de Tocqueville au pays des sauvages, Anthologie des textes d'Alexis de Tocqueville sur les autochtones américains. She's currently writing a book entitled Money and Empire in New France, a book that explores the infamous monnaie de carte, which are bills made out of playing cards bearing the portrait of Paris. These cards figure among the first paper currencies in the West, constituting an essential technology of overseas rule and a key element of imperial legal pluralism. And I've heard Kate give a talk about this, and it's really fascinating, and I look forward to the book. But today, her plenary talk is entitled Indigenizing New France, What's Left? Please join me in welcoming Kate Desbarras.
Thank you very much. I do sound awfully scattered when I hear that. When I hear that somebody in that description, can you hear me? Not so well. Okay, up the volume. Okay. I will start by thanking the co-presidents for their very generous offer to include a historian of New France. I don't think this is standard procedure at the Society for French Historical Studies. I accepted with the thought that I could perhaps give you a kind of taste of some of the richness and the range of the field. I think some of you have probably read Cécile Vidal and Gilles Lavard's Histoire de l'Amérique Française, but other than that, this is kind of off the center of your vision. Why in the midst of writing a book on money in New France am I talking about indigenizing indigenizing New France. A couple of reasons, and I think this talk grows a lot out of my teaching experience on the one hand. This is a very particular moment in Canada right now. We've just had a Truth and Reconciliation Commission that was a kind of brutal document that exposed a lot of the conditions. It's mostly a 19th residential school into the 20th century story. But one of the injunctions of the commission was that people do a better job of teaching the indigenous past. And when I teach New France, in any given class, I always have indigenous people self-identifying as indigenous. They come from communities around Montreal, places like Ganawage, and I'm conscious of, you know, how do I frame this for them? Also, another consideration, I was at a conference in Paris that was one in a series that Cécile Vidal and a number of other historians are organizing. They're in the process of creating a tremendously important collection of essays on hemispheric colonization, a huge comparative exercise. They've been doing it for 10 years. They put out essays, people comment, and, you know, when it's said and done, it's going to be an extraordinary volume for us to think with about comparative colonization. But what struck me as I was listening to it is, it's called Société Nouvelle, and it's all about colonization, indeed. And over again in the room, the people from Mexico, people from Canada, etc., we kept wondering, decolonizing the story of colonization, indeed, but you've kind of lost sight of the fact that historians of indigenous North America remind us, which is namely, until 1780, spatially, colonies are a quite marginal phenomenon in the continent, and that, you know, three-quarters of the continent, in some sense, is still very much inhabited by indigenous people. So how does this affect our history? So that brings me to thinking about, you know, indigenizing New France and perhaps what might be left when we try and do so. In honor of Pernilla, maybe I could start, however, with the world of French political economy. And I just want to read read a quotation. Imagine, Les Éphémérides du Citoyen asked its readers in 1766, a single narrow province running the length of the Rhine and also of the Danube, populated by 20 or 30,000 scattered families, having as capital, say, a town like Cologne, which belonged to the same diocese, government, and généralité, as another town at the mouth of the Danube on the Black Sea. Travel between them would involve a river trip along the full length of the Rhine, then a cross-country trek to the Danube. At the mouth of each river, powerful nations surrounded the unwieldy province. Worse yet, savages continually needing to be fought or wooed through presence and trade peopled the interior. It all added up to a very bizarre tableau. This was in the context, of course, of an argument that it was a good idea to ditch Canada because it had given France nothing but a coiffure bizarre and 100 million livres in debt. So this is in the context of the post-Seven Years' War discussions of debt. But looking at it with our eyes today, we might call this view Orientalist, with its view of savages who don't know their place, and Creole populations who seem vaguely familiar, yet somehow obscure. Historians, of course, have strained for almost half a century now to get beyond such derogatory outsider views of indigenous people, and Creoles as well, in colonial situations. The project is important, and it's far from finished. But it might be a useful starting point to remember that in exercises of decolonization, there's always something that's being indigenized or decolonized, a pre-existing narrative. What is it exactly that we want to indigenize? In the North American context, that something invariably or often involves New France. It's hard to avoid. Since the very first partisan uses of the toponym, as we shall see, I'll talk about that a little bit, it's been imagined as gigantic, virtually coeval with the North America, north of the Tropic of Cancer. So what is left when historians indigenized is hardly an elegant way of putting the question, but it captures something of the fact that as historians give us a fuller picture of indigenous America, New France loses ground. At this point, I want to do much of this with pictures, actually, to get you thinking about this question. So I want to think about maybe starting, what is it we want to indigenize in the first instance? It's settler colonialist narratives about New France and its North American past. And I just want to show you, it's lunchtime, you know, let's keep this light, if I can get there. Of course, the North American past has always been written about from, you know, for much of the 19th and 20th centuries from a settler national perspective. And what's characteristic of settler national perspectives, of course, is the sense that the national territory is somehow primordial, okay, that the territorial arrangements of the modern nation state are the ones that somehow are already going to be incipiently there in the pre-national past. And so New France, you know, like any other North American colonial or imperial situation, tends to get narrated that way. So I just want to, in the case of New France, this leads to some interesting peculiarities because, of course, it's narrated from about four different national traditions. There's a French metropolitan one that you can, you know, goes way back to, you know, L'Escarbot. I'll say a couple of words about that in a second. But there's also, there are English and French Canadian versions, and then there's another one which I would call Midwestern American that in a sense goes back to Reuben Gold Thwaites and his massive project of creating the Jesuit relations. Reuben Thwaites, I don't know if everybody knows this, but he was Frederick Jackson Turner's professor. And it's largely through, you know, being familiar with Thwaites' work, as Turner put it in his eulogy, not a eulogy, a memorial address that he published, Thwaites had published something like 7 edited collections a year for over a decade, and the Jesuit Relations 73 volumes are only part of that. But it's a kind of monument to this early Midwestern version of settler colonial nationalism, which of course is a kind of a reaction to Puritan-centered ones trying to give shape to the Western U.S. In this world. So let's just look at some of these quickly. This is the always already world of Wikipedia. Who knows where it was produced? But my guess, if you look through the edits, is that this would have been done by Canadians. And again, you get the sense. New France as giant. It goes from the Arctic Circle or close to. All the way, this is post 1713 because we have Hudson Bay, all the way to the Gulf of Mexico. It shows Canada, Louisiana. The title, by the way, is New France at its apogee. Okay, so we have, which is always where you want to map it. Canada, Louisiana, etc. What's, you know, the work that these maps do, of course, is just persuade us and convince us that colonial imperial era places are homogeneous kind of arenas of sovereignty that you can actually map and that, you know, you can draw lines and there they are on the map. And so this is one version. Here's, you can guess possibly where this one, this is a Quebec National Atlas showing New France, and New France is everything. It's everything except it doesn't go very far south, it doesn't take us to the Gulf of Mexico, and again, this is capturing something of a Quebecois historical imagination whereby a Quebec future is possible with this giant New France past that you can kind of hang on to. No lines here, it's just everywhere. The Canadian one, here's a Canadian National Atlas, and it's amusing, it's got a sort of spirit of fair play. We have a slightly smaller New France, we have more Rupert's Land, a bit more space accorded to the British colonies. We've got lines now that are dots, there's a kind of vague acknowledgement that things are a little fuzzy, but we're still prepared to create these homogeneous surfaces and draw lines. American maps are interesting. This one is typical. Timothy Breen, and I would say this, you'll find this
sort of everywhere. New France has been edged
up to the St. Lawrence Valley. It's now something completely different. Louisiana is not part of New France. They're separate things, maybe kind of parallel. We're not sure. We're not quite sure what they are. But in any case, New France is up there. There's a little bit of acknowledgement of indigenous people, but not much. And I can't resist showing this one. This is kind of the world of global history in an American Bedford St. Martin, where Louisiana is up in Manitoba. Quebec has disappeared. I mean, New France has disappeared, and Quebec, I guess, also goes into the Canadian Midwest. So this is the world. We take these sorts of things for granted, but people see them all the time, and it's low-hanging fruit for my purposes, but I think it does serve as a kind of useful metonym in some sense for the content carried by settler colonial narratives, and you know, textbooks are a good place to find them, and we all think we're sophisticated and we move beyond this, but at some level, this is lurking in the background in our historical thinking. So that's, you know, that's kind of the world of settler colonial narratives. One move that I think is important in decolonizing the history before we kind of move on to the indigenous section, although I first want to say, notice, of course, there are no indigenous people in, there's no sign or trace of any indigenous people. And, you know, what's going on here, and this is an important phenomenon, the degree to which we have imagined these pre-imperial spaces as precursors to early modern national ones has meant that we have not been able to imagine indigenous territoriality, okay, because we're looking for boundaries and lines which don't even apply to European senses of territoriality at the time, but they certainly don't apply to indigenous people. So indigenous people appear on maps with culture, they're in anthropology atlases, they have culture areas, but the two don't meet. So that's just another point. But one important move, I think, is to pay attention as historians to language, to toponyms, and to where they appear, what are the circumstances in which they appear. And I would venture that there's almost no circumstance in which the toponym New France appears and it is not doing ideological work. It's usually always in a kind of partial partisan context. And let me just, you know, you might as well know about it. The first time the toponym, or a version of it, this is a Latinate version of New Gaul, so a 16th century historian can tell me what's going on in Gaul versus France at this point, but it's Nova Gallia, and it's in the map produced by Gerolamo di Verrazzano, brother of the explorer. The explorer has been killed on Guadeloupe by now. And this is kind of offered up to François Ier as what I tend to call toponymic gifts. You know, these are people speaking to their patrons and offering them a gift of, I'm putting Nova Gallia on this map, but I'm also putting Angoulême, etc., and, you know, hope that there might be some kind of exchange. But, of course, it's part of the mental universe of anti-Iberian imperial imagination. You know, we're entering into a sphere, the world created by intercetera, etc., and we're breaking into that space. The first time the toponym appears in print is in the Parisian lawyer Marc Lescarbot's History of New France, that's published in 1601. And this is a book that's going to have a fair bit of traction. It's going to go through several editions. It's going to be translated into English and German immediately and read quite widely. So it's, you know, really starting the work of cultural production, of the idea that there is this thing called New France. This is, of course, happening at a time, so New France gets its history before there really is anything on the ground. There are 28 people sitting in a fortification of Quebec at this time, in the Habitation de Québec. It's fortified, two stories. It has moats and cannons, and, you know, they're armed for trouble at this point. So nothing is very certain They're more worried about competitors to their monopoly on fur than they are about indigenous people at this point, but they're fortified nonetheless. The Lescarbot's image of New France is worth lingering over again because it's going to set the tone. It's going to set the tone for ways of imagining New France. So Notre Nouvelle France aura pour limite du côté ouest la terre jusqu'à la mer dite Pacifique, en deçà du tropique du Cancer, au midi les îles et la mer Atlantique du côté de Cuba et l'île espagnole, au levant la mer du Nord hors dite la Nouvelle France, au septentrion cette terre qui est dite inconnue vers la mer glacée jusqu'au pôle arctique. Okay, so from the Arctic. This is New France. This is incidentally the language of practically all charters. You know, whether it's New England, the Hudson's Bay Company, they're all doing, of course, this kind of claim to everything, basically. So if you superimposed all of the claims, you'd get something interesting. So here we have it in the world of narrative, kind of travel narrative. But Lescarbot, again, he's very much writing in an anti-Iberian idiom. He says, literally, there's too much New Spain out there in the world of print. Here's my New France. Here's our New France. And, of course, there is an argument. There's an argument for colonization going on there. The first place New France appears in a kind of juridical, legal context is in the charter of the company of 100 associates that's created by Richelieu. This is one of these interesting early modern quasi-state corporations that are being cobbled together that mix different kinds of jurisdiction. They have military power, they have privileges for trade, etc., and the Compagnie de la Nouvelle France, and its geography is very similar. Except it says, it's always future-looking and expansive. There's a latency. It says, the company will have jurisdiction wherever Frenchmen will travel. Okay, and that's a crucial notion here. It's the idea, again, that this New France, this notion of New France is being, in this case, constructed as the way in which jurisdiction over mobile French people will be constructed. So that's the concern. It's not a taking of possession. It's a granting trade privileges to French people and creating a French legal instrument. So we have to pay attention to the different circumstances in which France appears. Cartography, of course, is one of the important places where you get visual or spatial representations of this notion of New France. Cartography is an essential and important part of the building and mounting imperial archive that is being created wherever the French go. New France is particularly heavily mapped. I don't have comparisons, relative to Caribbean areas, but it's precisely the territorial ambiguity of the place that seems to generate a lot of this mapping. But I want us to look at a map, and I'll have more details as we go along, and I'm going to use this to get us thinking a little further. A map by a fellow by the name of Jean-Baptiste Franquelin. This map was produced in 1699. As you can see here, it's made in four pieces, and it's actually gigantic. I don't know if any of you have seen the Coronelli globes that are sitting in the Bibliothèque Nationale. They're huge. Like these are these sorts of monumental representations of the world according to Louis XIV, in a sense. So here is Franquelin. These are maps produced by somebody who has lived for 20 years in North America. It's not a sort of, somebody sitting in a cabinet in France who's never, because many of the maps take this form. Franquelin has been on the ground. He's traveled extensively throughout North America. He's met fur traders. He's met all kinds of people. And this map, this is a manuscript map. It wasn't circulating. So this is intended for administrative eyes, in a sense. This is the state building its own knowledge, in a sense, of itself.
Do I want to say anything else? Oh, yeah. So he occupies the position of royal hydrographer. Okay. This is another. This is a position that you're seeing evolving kind of simultaneously in French arsenals, a sign that for empire builders, in some sense, rivers, waterways are absolutely crucial. Historians of empire speak of the importance of notions of empire of access. Long before anybody's concerned about territorial possession of any sort, they're worrying about sea routes, sea claims, access to coasts, finding inland waterways, lakes, etc. And you very much see this in this map. The sort of most important physiographic detail on these maps, as you can kind of see even maybe from the back of the room, are waterways. They're like capillaries everywhere, waterways, coasts, etc. So that's an essential feature of this map. Another one, as again, maybe you can even see it from way back there, the Nouvelle France. Again, can you see it? It's like imminent, it's sort of serene, it's everywhere. So here again, we have this vision in 1699 of a new France as absolutely gigantic and basically coeval with North America. The title of this map is Partie de l'Amérique septentrionale. I can't read the bit right before La Nouvelle France, but it sort of intends to be impartial in the sense that okay, we're going to map Nouvelle Angleterre, Nouvelle Albanie, etc., all these other places. But if you look at it carefully, it seems to imply that these places are actually all within New France. You are getting a kind of strange version of a sort of Louis XIV universal monarchy ideal here. And, you know, believe me, there are plenty of memos coming from colonial officials stationed overseas offering up these visions. You just have to buy Manhattan, or you could conquer New York, or what have you, establish a universal monarchy, and it'll be great. So there's a lot of this. So, you know, impartiality maybe, but also maybe this this larger vision. There's another striking thing about this map, however, that's quite interesting. And that is, if you look at the vast majority of the toponyms, the place names, they're virtually all indigenous. Okay, so this is a New France that is pretty well all indigenous. So contemporaries had no trouble, at least this map maker thought it was okay. But, and that tells you something. So indigenous place names, absolutely everywhere. And the, you know, it's hard to know exactly what was going on in the head of Jean-Baptiste Franquelin when he made this map. But he is capturing one particular type of imperial imagination, one way of thinking about New France. And that is as a kind of feudal space where you simply juxtapose French possession on top of existing jurisdictions. Okay. And so we don't just get place names. We get place names implying territoriality and possession. It's the pays des Vivinois, pays de la nation, contrée, pays de la nation des Sioux, etc. Okay, so there's a sense of attributing political identity and territorial identity within this kind of supra-entity that is New France. So I'll just, you know, what it all means, we'll think about that in a minute. But it is quite striking. Minimally, we can say we are not seeing on this map the kind of ideology that says that indigenous people are nothing but wandering savages. They don't have, you know, they don't have places that can in any customary legal sense be considered property or otherwise. Just note another thing, of course, this map has no lines functioning as borders, unlike the, you know, Wikipedia textbook versions. And so you can go through most of the maps
that you will find of New France at this time do not show lines. When they do show lines, it's often you see some of the the kind of invented or not invented. You see the notion of natural frontiers. There's a 1656 Nicolas Sanson map that puts just invents a chain of mountains. New Spain down here, New France up here, just totally made up, but it satisfied somebody's idea that there should be a boundary. So it's an interesting map. It captures some of the ways of thinking, imperial ways of thinking about New France at the time, that has no trouble with the idea of indigenous people. Indeed, absolutely depends on it and is kind of making the best out of a situation of necessity, a bit the way Louis the 14th and others can kind of encompass all these spaces that are linguistically and otherwise very different. There's even an image here of indigenous people actually having perhaps, it's symbolic, but having helped construct the map, and they are going to help construct this vast space called New France. So it's clear that we're kind of entirely in the realm of imperial imagination, mapping, and the real question is, what's behind all of this? What can we say about what's behind all of this? So what I'd like to do is just use the map to help us think a little bit about different kinds of geographies of power that are actually unfolding on the ground and the difficulties of mapping them and thinking about them properly. The spaces, one of the spaces that are alluded to in some ways here, hidden on the center of the map itself, are ones that today we might indeed want to call colonial. Colonial in the sense of these are the spaces where people of European descent are in some sense a majority of the local population. You have the creation of some kind of European French jurisdiction here. There are courts, people are going to them for their civil, their criminal court cases, etc. So you on the map visually, you see this on I've taken the two side bits. Okay, so this is, what are we seeing here? We're seeing the St. Lawrence Valley. Okay, and he has documented, what you're seeing here is every last seigneury. Mm-hmm. So this is a space of seigneurial tenure. Okay, so one of the ways, and this is what certainly Alan Greer has argued in his recent book, colonial spaces are, in a sense, quintessentially spaces where property formation is being constructed, okay, where settler tenure is happening and it has legal definition, and in this case we have a kind of seigneurial tenure taking shape. And this is unique. We just heard a talk earlier on Detroit. It doesn't even exist everywhere within the French Atlantic Empire, and you have to explain the story of seigneurial of colonial property in each setting where it emerged. And it takes particular forms for particular reasons. So here it is as seigneurial tenure. Colonies, here's the capital of New France, an image of the town of Quebec. So colonial spaces are not just spaces of a particular type of law, they're also very much governed spaces. And here you see, transformation of the landscape, public buildings, here mostly churches, government buildings, the palace of the intendant, etc. So very strong, a very visible, strong state, but also church presence here. And again, these features of the colonial capital we can really link to the larger presence, to the presence of this space as an island among indigenous people. The reason the church is so strong, the reason we have all these things going on, has to do with efforts to missionize, etc. Okay, the colonies as governed spaces, and we see that on the map. The map betrays something else about colonial spaces in New France, and that is they too
they too encompass indigenous people. Here the image, again, it's made to look very peaceful, it's very happy. If you've seen a picture like this on a map 30 years earlier, that cauldron would have been roasting a Jesuit. So this is it's a strikingly similar image, but it's being deployed here in a very peaceful way to suggest this kind of peaceful propinquity. Okay. So it is the case that in the St. Lawrence Valley, even a colonial space, you have at least seven villages that are indigenous in the sense that mainly you have Iroquoian, you have places like Ganawagi, Ganapatagi, Wendake, Huron spaces, but also Abenaki, Odanak, etc. Okay, so five of these villages, at least, in which the language, the way of life, is not French, is indigenous, where people are not, they're not farming, they're not, or at least they're not farming wheat. So again, the landscape all around them has been transformed. People are growing familiar crops. In these villages, they're growing corn. Okay? They're growing corn, beans, and squash. And they are traveling to hunting grounds north of the St. Lawrence Valley. So even the places that seem the most colonial have within them indigenous villages. So a very, very sort of complicated space. These colonial spaces, of course, are going to they're going to be nodes that send traders, missionaries, and others deep into that network of lakes that we were talking, that we saw earlier. So by the end of the 1660s, 1670s, you have posts, and even some forts all around the Great Lakes. A few hundred people. We're talking about only a few hundred people in them. By the end of the century, the French have gone down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico, and into the 18th century, they will also, of course, reach the Missouri River and the Saskatchewan. So these little colonial nodes are sending people outward. But what do we make of those places? They're mapped as New France. How do we talk about them? How do we think about them? Of course, indigenous historians think about them quite simply as indigenous space. What's your problem? We just have a few hundred French people wandering around and who are perhaps being incorporated into indigenous societies, indeed, have become fictive kin, etc. And there's a tremendous amount of truth to that, and I think that's an essential part of the story. A landmark effort to think these things through, many of you probably are familiar with it, was Richard White's book, The Middle Ground, in the 19th. First came out in 1991, and what he tried to do imaginatively was think about drawing on Henri Fez's work on space, thinking about the emergence of a kind of a space that has coherence. It's not a state. It's not, what is it? It's some kind of space that emerges by virtue of the nature of encounters. He's trying very hard, of course, to avoid using the word frontier that was so freighted in early American history. And what he saw, was a space that had been very much transformed by the presence of Europeans already by the time the French are getting there. Epidemics that have fractured communities, epidemics that, of course, have unleashed a tremendous amount of war. The so-called mourning wars of the Haudenosaunee Five Nations people, whose motivation for warfare would be to go out and replace the dead in the population. And that would kind of transform a traditional form of warfare that might involve taking a few captives into something that goes a bit haywire. So White saw a space that was, it's not a space of colonization, particularly. It's not a space of colonization. It's not a space of conquest. But it's a space suffering and experiencing imperial effects that create conditions that work to the advantage of this small number of French people. And he argued that what happens is the French are able to enter, in very small numbers, enter this world, enter into fictive kinship relations with indigenous people, and actually play the role of mediator, responding to needs that troubled societies have had, occupying this role by virtue of being people who can bring in goods from an Atlantic network. So that was all very well and good, and it inspired a lot of people. The notion of middle ground has traveled to, Vietnam. It's traveled to Timothy Snyder's book Bloodlands. Cites Richard White as an influence. Historians of Indigenous America were not so happy. And so for the last 15 minutes since the book has been published, they've been hammering away. And hammering away back in the direction of saying, you've just made up, you've basically made up this idea that this space is so fractured by epidemics. It really is still very much an indigenous space where social identities, polities remain basically intact. And this work has involved doing the very difficult business of trying to reconstruct kin-based, stateless societies, very mobile societies that are very, very hard to see in the French records, because the French records have all kinds of seasonal biases, apart from the colonial way of thinking. They are seeing people only at certain times of the year, so it's very, very difficult to reconstruct ways of life. And I'll just say that this work, it's by definition difficult. It's by definition interdisciplinary. It happens through people. They are doing things like trying to reconstruct landscapes. What are the landscapes? What are the animals that people would have been hunting, etc. Working with that, working also way more with such fragmentary indigenous language sources that we have. We are nowhere near, we just don't have the kind of material that is available in Nahuatl for Mexico. But we do have quite extraordinary things like Jesuit dictionaries that nobody has really worked with until now. People are still reading them quite naively and extractively, getting excited about a word that they find, again, without understanding how the dictionaries have come together. But I'll just say quickly that I'll give you an example of a rereading of indigenous space that's happened as a result of this work. The Village of Great Kaskakia was read by Richard White as one of the archetypal multi-ethnic villages that had been peopled by refugee fragments from Iroquois attacks, epidemics, etc. It's now being reread by historian Robert Morrissey as instead a village, the location of which is very much determined by a newly the term ethnogenesis is what people use, a kind of community that comes together, exploiting the fact of being at the edges of two very, very different kinds of landscape, the technical terms of woodland people, hunter-gatherers with some agriculture, and on the other side of the kind of divide, grasslands that the bison work over. So grasslands, grasslands and bison are hard. It's okay if you're riding a horse, but otherwise it's quite difficult to negotiate. And they managed to do it as pedestrian bison hunters as he puts it. But the long and the short of the story is that the patient, deep historical reconstruction of landscape allows him to sort of look at phenomena that are so easy to read as reactions to some colonial policy or what have you. In a world, of course, where all of the written documents are produced by people who barely understand what they're looking at. So it's a very painstaking work of reconstructing this kind of situation. And again, the direction of most of the scholars working here is in the direction of insisting on this as being a kind of coherent indigenous space. And this is, you know, echoed in some of the written 19th century history of the Ojibwa people. We have 19th century history that, you know, that have Europeans appearing once in a while, you know, as kind of on the margins. So that's kind of the direction of the literature. I'll just close with another instance of indigenization in a very different territory that would be completely unfamiliar to most of you. And this is a territory that occupies about, well, 2/3 of modern-day Quebec. And here the work of indigenization is being done, of course, by indigenous people. So the Cree themselves, the Cree and the Innu, for the last 40 years, have been in the face of hydroelectric projects, been very strenuously doing things like mapping their own terrain, mapping their own hunting territories. They have, they're producing an atlas, there's a Cree atlas that is in the works right now, more than 18,000 toponyms, you know, many of which have, of course, been written over in Quebec historical atlases. And some of this work is actually showing in an interesting way is that here you have a map produced by a Jesuit in 1731, and what they've uncovered here, the people at the Cree Cultural Institute, is that basically he's spot on. You know, that he has got his geography, his toponymy, the location of Lake, with a few exceptions. This is actually very accurate. Okay? So this is not to say that this is what's going on everywhere, but this is a unique, interesting circumstance in which we actually have contemporary, the indigenous people are still around. They're still around, and they're, you know, from the work gleaning their view of the world, we can see that that this particular Jesuit and his particular mapping must have tapped incredible networks. These are places, of course, where no French person went. Okay, so he is gathering together geographic information that his informants are giving him and map it. We would appear not to be in New France. Why do we have the map? We have the map because the Naval Department asks Pierre-Michel Laure to produce the map to get a picture of the fiscal situation of this region. Jurisdictionally, for the French, this region, even though there are no French people in it, is called the Domaine du Roi, a kind of neo-feudal fiscal deal, which is an arrangement, in a sense, for patronage, for, you know, people from Quebec, and otherwise, oh, well, you know, we'll give them the Domaine du Roi, and they can make a bit of money. So we have this, you know, this need for a kind of double vision all the time. It's jurisdictionally, in some sense, New France produces the document, but there are barely any French people in it. So I'll just maybe conclude quickly. Where does this leave us when we try and think about New France? New France, as people indigenize, does very much lose a lot of ground. That's the first thing to say. Second thing to say maybe is just for the record, New France is not a colony. This is something, you know, when people sort of think about it, it's not a colony, notwithstanding what the Bibliothèque Nationale de France subject catalog says. So it's not a colony. It's very much a composite, heterogeneous. It's more than even than an archipelago of colonies. And I think one might retain, as a way of thinking about it, to not forget about the very real imperial effects, just notions of imperial formation along the lines that Anne-Laure Stoller uses. And in this sense, we might want to argue that New France is the archetypal imperial formation. And what does she mean by that? She doesn't say anything about New France, of course. She's talking about later empires. A space that is, it thrives on territorial ambiguity. It's what actually allows the thing to survive. It, of course, depends entirely on social imaginaries, blueprints never realized, It is full of turbid taxonomies, shifting categories of rule, etc. And you can see all of these things if you look at the complex, if you zero in on any of the complex places that make up the New France as it is mapped. Thank you.
Time for some discussion. Before we do that, I should point out that there are some brownies and cookies at the back of the room, and people just go get some and eat them.
Sorry? Oh. Off or on?
On,
okay.
Well, what, some people got coffee.
You said he was coming back.
Is it on?
It's about how what you discussed today plays into contemporary historiographical debates in Quebec, because I really appreciate what you talk about in terms of the historical reality of ambiguity in the earlier period. But as you nodded towards, for people who, whether they're Quebecois nationalists or not, it's a little, there's a kind of competition where people want to nowadays, some people want to see this territorial integrity that's not New France, it's Quebec. It's,
absolutely.
And there's a new effacing of Indigenous peoples that takes place. I mean, when the last time there was a discussion about referendum, and then there was some suggestion that the Indigenous peoples in the North would not want to go with it was sort of like a shock, like, oh, but why would, you know, they're part of this. I mean, you can actually say this over and over. I mean, there's this kind of imperative of Franco-Canadians, and I say this affectionately because I'm really interested in this community and their identity, but that is in so many ways based on an effacement of everything that you're kind of outlining here.
Absolutely. It's very, very complex. I sometimes teach a course called the Quebec Indigenous Experience with where I bring in all kinds of, you know, head of the Quebec Assembly of First Nations, that kind of thing. And my Francophone students at the end of the term can't recognize the world they're living in. It blows their minds apart. Mm-hmm. So my favorite example of the kind of tensions that you're talking about, there was the Quebec Toponymy Commission wanted to celebrate the introduction of the Quebec Bill 101, the language law that made it compulsory for people to go to public school in French unless they had a, you know, history outside in English Canada, blah, blah, blah. So how did they propose to celebrate the anniversary of Bill 101? They were proposing to name 101 islands in Cree territory that had been flooded by hydroelectric projects. So I was trying to get a reading on where we were with this, and it's still, you know, is it still going on? Maybe it's still going on. So you're absolutely right. Most Francophone Quebecers they're still fighting against Canada. They're still fighting against the British Empire, and it's very hard to take this on board. And as you rightly say, the 1995 referendum was a kind of, you know, you had the Cree saying, wait a minute, if you're going to have a referendum, we're going to have a referendum. And 99% of the Cree were not interested in having their territories excised from the Quebec territory. So this brought the discussion absolutely to the fore. In the wake of this, the Quebec government, and I think it was a Parti Québécois government at the time, they have very cleverly now posed themselves as speaking, quote-unquote, nation-to-nation to Indigenous people, working out people with the agreements with the Innu, with the Inuit to the north. So that's the, you know, it's nation-to-nation, but within, you know, we're all understanding that Quebec territorial integrity will not be violated, and that, you know, if we move on into the future as a separate space, you know, you're coming with us, is kind of, that's, but it's very delicate. And it's delicate for historians. You know, Francophone historians, by and large, are not doing Indigenous history. It's just not an interest. There are other more important things to be working on. And to give you another example, I mean, the best known Quebec Francophone historian of Indigenous things, a guy called Alain Beaulieu, he's, you know, very... there was recently... Montreal's newspaper La Presse had a special issue on the question of, was Montreal unceded Mohawk territory? Da, 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 da. So the Montreal flag has now has incorporated a Mohawk symbol into its center. Of course, sidelining any claims that other Indigenous groups might have to get anyway. So it was a very typical move of La Presse, the Montreal newspaper, to not ask anybody from Ganawagi. Plenty of people at Ganawagi who could speak French, who could have written a piece. They didn't. They just didn't enter their minds. So that's... I would say that's the world in which we live in. It's complicated. Very famous Quebec scholar Gérard Bouchard, his brother was the head of the Parti Québécois for a while. It's interesting to watch his trajectory. He's now writing novels that involve Indigenous people. He's something's going on there. But anyway, Claire. Hi.
Thank you, and appreciated the shout out to Bob Morrissey, who's one of our beloved colleagues.
Yeah.
And one of the things, a student of his wrote a paper in this class I taught that was really interestingly questioning how, even when people try and write the kinds of history that you're talking about, they're often writing as early Americanists, or they're writing as French historians, or they're writing as British whatever historians, and that part of it is the national traditions. So I've been trying to get Bob to see himself as a French historian and to come to this conference. Early America is really his place.
No, the Indigenous...
Place.
Yeah, so a lot of this Indigenous history of the Great Lakes region is being done by American historians. And like Richard White, they are consciously positioning themselves in the tradition of the new history of the American West. Bob consciously positions himself as somebody who's decolonizing 19th century U.S. history that sees the Midwest as a kind of ruralized, you know, on the way to capitalism and industrialization, a kind of, you know, rural space. So he's working against that. So absolutely. I mean, can we ever escape it? Probably not.
That's what I was going to ask you. I mean, speaking to this crowd of French historians, what advice do you have for how do we
say,
do that differently?
I would say now, if you're serious, it's no longer acceptable to not try and confront Indigenous languages. That's thing number one. There are revitalization projects going on all over the place. Student John Bishop is now fluent in Cree. I have somebody else who's working on Jesuit dictionaries. She's working with people who are reconstructing, who are trying to resurrect the Huron language. There are people speaking Iroquois. And so languages, just like everybody else. You know, we've been trying to write this field. There are few written records, but we've been trying to do it with zero understanding, you know. And the toponyms is just one example. They are so, you know, they're saturated with meaning. So just even in terms of recreating a sense of a place. So that's just basic, you know, basic history. The other problem for a lot of the Indigenous history being written, you know, I guess I could say this in this audience, people don't understand the French records. They're not trained as French historians, so they're reading them very... First of all, they you know, it's often considered just totally acceptable to work from translations. You know, if you're going to work with the Jesuit Relations, go work with the 17th century versions. Don't work with the English, you know, with Thwaites' 19th century translation. That's another... So It's just exposure to a maximal number of traditions, scholarship, records from all, you know, it's not just the French who produce records, of course, it's, you know, they're coming out of Pennsylvania, and you've got to use all those records to get multiple views. But there's a way in which, you know, one will never escape. But I do think just working in multiple languages is, you know, just disorienting yourself a bit is a you know, lesson one in being a good historian and being aware that that's the tradition. Richard White, the Middle Ground, Indigenization. All the Canadian Indigenous historians say, "Well, your Middle Ground doesn't go north of the Great Lakes, for goodness sake." You know, it's all happening there too, and you've cut it off. You know, all of the Daniel Richter before the Revolution, facing east, they're heading to the American Revolution. It's just like, you know, and so people writing within that, well, I mean, I want to be read by early Americans. Of course I'm going to end it with the American Revolution. But, you know, you see it from another vantage point and you think, come on, you've just completely undermined your whole enterprise.
So I was recently at a conference up in Halifax where it was a cartography conference focusing on New France. But what was really striking was the contingent of archaeologists
I haven't mentioned archaeology.
By sort of working on the ground in Mi'kma'ki territory, were leagues ahead of everyone else. And were really, I think, combined with the language and the cartography, coming up with some great stuff.
Absolutely. Archaeology is discipline number one, and it's behind all of this other stuff as well that I was talking about. And that was the beauty, you know, another book that doesn't get talked about, but that really was pioneering, was Bruce Trigger's work on the Huron. That was 1976. And what he did was he turned dry archaeological reports into a story centered on the children of Atensic. Who are the children of Atensic? So the French have always known the Huron as the people with this funny headdress. Well, let's start by restoring their own sense. And I'm convinced, you know, the more I think of it, Bruce Trigger was also an archaeologist. He was an expert on Africa. And I think that he was able to imagine giving substance to an indigenous story and history to a much greater degree by virtue of also operating in the African field.
If I could just ask a question first. I'm interested in sort of circling back to the maps you showed at the beginning of your presentation, maps that school kids or college students see in survey courses, and how, once we start doing the kind of work or we listen to Indigenous historians, what's the future of those maps in our textbooks?
I hope those maps disappear.
What replaces them?
What replaces them?
Yeah.
That's a very good question. I think it's going to be all kinds of things, like, on the French side, maps that show things like mobility, that show movement, that show networks, that give a sense. There are times when there's nobody there, there are times when there are some people there, there are times when there are two, there are times when there are 50, just something that gives a sense of people moving around and their presence and the flows of goods, the flows of things, things like that that allow you to imagine spatially what's there and what's not there. I think on the indigenous side, restoring indigenous toponymy. I mean, you know, it's laborious, but I was just listening to myself say there were, 28 people on the shores of the St. Lawrence. Of course, this is Chesapeake. It's got a completely different name for the people living there. It's not St. Lawrence. So slowly we could start doing that. But it's like banging your head against a wall. I have this PhD student, John Bishop, you know, we're thinking, how on earth am I going to write a dissertation that anybody's going to read? He's thinking of organizing it around a dictionary. Like, each chapter is going to introduce a place name that is unfamiliar to us, but that's absolutely crucial and central. The more we understand the St. Lawrence Valley, the more this notion that it's an empty space, there are no Iroquois, da-da-da-da, well, it's full of Innu. And it's full of Innu fishing for eel. These are really, really important eel fights. And, you know, now people are noticing eels everywhere. They're noticing the Jesuits snatching up eels and buying eels. And the first governor general saying, I want a seigneury there because there are a lot of eels there. And the Jesuits replying, you know, and it's very, this is the first case where you get a seigneury, quote unquote, given to, the Jesuits are saying, you got to stop taking these eels, you know, these Innu eels, so we're going to create a property regime that protects you. We're going to call this, and the Innu of Siri are the seigneur. They are the seigneur of this property for a while. Anyway, so that I would say that kind of thing. Mapping the grasslands, mapping where the bison go, you know, all kinds of things like that. Anything other than, you know, straight lines and territoriality that's everywhere, always, all the time. I mean, I think, you know, I think, frankly, modern states are just as bumpy and full of holes and enclaves, and we should, you know, if we actually thought a bit more about the reality of power on the ground and its geographies today, we would have a little less trouble with this, but anyway.
Similar, but maybe not even as good as that one. But it had to do with the toponyms, the two maps you showed us with the Jesuit one in 1731 and the earlier one in 1599, I think. 1699, sorry.
That one we're not so sure of. I don't know.
About the dates? Or how accurate it is.
I'm not sure about the, because that kind of work hasn't been done.
Right. So what I was thinking about both of those is that the functionality of them and the ways that having certainly semi-fixed bodies of water in the indigenous terms, and then also the peoples that one might encounter there, is a way for explorers to try to situate themselves in what is otherwise completely unknown. And you went to the direction now on her follow-up that I was thinking about, which was where you place the animals and using narrative sources in order to try to populate it with more than just people, but also
absolutely
plants and animals,
absolutely,
and so on. Yeah,
absolutely. The animals are key. Animals and others, you know, as you say, plants. Coffee time. Great. Thank you.